Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Peter Gethers, author of My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, thank you. Very happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so delighted. I read your book when it came...
I know you did.
I read your book when it came out in 2017, but it's just come out in paperback. I encourage all listeners to read this very heartfelt memoir. Peter, how did the
this
idea...
This is already my favorite interview that I've ever given, by the way, so I get that out.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. That's good. Let's see if it goes downhill from here. Anyway, how did the idea begin?
Well, it was a fairly simple idea when it started, and it went through various permutations. Basically, my mother, which I can explain in a little bit, had an extraordinarily vital and important life and life in food.
Yes.
And basically, when she turned 90, which was 3 years before she died, which is now 5 years ago, I realized that once she, in middle age, in her 50s, began a career in food, my entire life changed as a result of it. Not just her life, but my life, her husband's life, my brother's life, all our friends' lives. And I, for me in particular, I realized that from the time I was in my early 20s, which is when she became the queen of the food world, every single thing and every single decision I've made that had any import completely revolved around food and drink.
And all your decisions?
I bought a house in the middle of nowhere in Sicily because it was on the grounds of the best restaurant in Sicily.
Okay.
As a profession, I do all sorts of complicated things in addition to writing books. I produce television and write books and write television and film, and I wound up producing food shows and editing cookbooks, among other things. My longtime girlfriend is the top food literary agent in New York.
Oh, cool.
So things are food relevant for me. And when my mom turned 90, I realized I knew a lot about what she had done, or thought I did. It turned out I didn't know quite as much as I thought, but I didn't know what foods were really important to her. And by that time, my mom had had a massive and severe stroke, which is a big part of the story because her recovery and response to that was genuinely extraordinary and inspiring. So I realized I wanted to find out what foods were important to her, because I realized I didn't know that. I knew that food was important to her, but I didn't know what foods or why. So I began talking to her and found out what dishes were meaningful to her, and found out that food wasn't just about taste, although taste was crucial to my mother, especially after the stroke, because it was one of her senses that survived fully.
Oh, great.
But that food had a history and an emotional connection to things in the past. So some recipes were not the most difficult to make and were not the absolute best tasting, but they resonated with her and were important to her because they were connected to my dad or mm-hmm. my childhood mm-hmm. or her life in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to really think that food had a different meaning than I had thought.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't and just food.
It wasn't just food, that food actually was meaningful in a life situation.
Mm-hmm.
And not just on the table. And then I decided, well, I can cook. I was not and am not a great cook, but I'm not horrible. But I mean, I was not capable of many things that my mother was capable of. But I decided I would put together her fantasy breakfast, lunch, and dinner menus, and I would learn to cook everything.
Mm-hmm. Because she couldn't any longer, correct?
She could not. That's correct.
Right.
She could not cook. She could criticize.
Yeah, right.
She
could
did.
Eat. She could criticize.
She could eat.
Taste.
Her taste was completely unimpaired.
Oh, good.
But because of the stroke, she couldn't really cook anymore. But she could instruct and teach. And and truly, the taste of food became ever more important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent a year really talking to her about food, which led to talking about her life, which led to my learning how to cook things, some of which were so simple, such as matzo brei, which, as I say in my book, a monkey can actually make that. It's totally easy. To something that was the first recipe that Wolfgang Puck ever taught my mother to make because she wound up working with Wolf, which is something called a salmon kulibiak, which I describe in the book. It took me 2 days and about 3/4 of a bottle of bourbon to make properly.
Well, that's great. That
so
is
that's
just
really
great.
That's the conceit of the book, is it's really what I learned about my mother's life, how extraordinary it was, and how it's perceived through food, all of which I learned how to cook and give the recipes to and describe my semi-hapless attempts to make
them. Right. And you must be a much better cook now.
I am, partly because I learned how to do certain things and how to think about food.
Some of those fancy recipes taught you different techniques that you could then apply to different food.
True, and I did. I took a knife skills class, and miraculously I still have all my digits. more important than the skills, because I don't have the patience to get those skills the way a real chef does.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a certain kind of fearlessness in the kitchen, which I think is more important than knowing exactly how to cut things. I learned to trust my instincts.
Right.
And sometimes that winds up being messy, just like in life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it winds up being even more delicious than the original recipe, just like in real life.
Right. But you also probably aren't scared by many recipes that you would have been scared of before.
No, I'm not saying I would succeed, but I would try to make anything.
Right.
And in fact, one of my two or three favorite parts of the book, my favorite difficult thing in the book, as I said, I've gotten to work with food. So I have gotten to work with a guy I think is a genius, Yotam Ottolenghi. I sent him an email saying that one of the things my mother picked for dinner was quail. And my mother, when I was a child, she's the only person I ever knew who made quail or squab or little birds like that. And so I said to him, we had quail at your restaurant in London at Nopi. My mother, by this point, didn't have a favorite particular recipe, but I said, that was the most delicious bird I've ever tasted. It was quail and rhubarb sauce. And I was terrified of cooking with rhubarb also because I don't even know how to peel it or anything. And so I said, could you send me the recipe? And he did, with a note, which I repeated or reprinted exactly in my book. He said, I don't know how much good this will do you. He goes, I'm not sure I could even cook from this, but here are my notes on that recipe. Some of it is for four people in my kitchen, and some of it is for 100 people at the restaurant. So good luck. And it was all, and there was no explanation. So there were things like, use this ingredient to make the licorice dirt. And I didn't want to bother him anymore, so I didn't want to email him back and say things like, what the heck is licorice dirt? But I went, well, it's licorice and dirt, so I can maybe figure out what it is. And so
is licorice related to rhubarb, perhaps?
I don't know, but he used licorice, and of course I didn't even know what kind of licorice, so I bought like licorice candy, figuring how bad could it be. And in fact, it all turned out superb. It was absolutely delicious. I suspect it was nothing like what I actually ate at his restaurant in London.
Right.
But it was unbelievably good, although it was, I think I lost 10 pounds trying to figure it out. I have no patience, and I'm bad at reading recipes because I get creative, and after a mm-hmm. while I just go, oh, I'll just do something, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to be precise and accurate. So some of his measurements were not in ounces, you know, they were in other forms of measurements. And I just went, all right, well, this is about an ounce. Okay, right. I'll figure this, you know. But uh-huh. it turned out great. And I went, okay, no reason to be afraid of making something where I don't even know what I'm making.
Right, right. So your mom, Judy Gethers, came yep. from a very strong food stock. Her family yeah. owned the famous Jewish dairy restaurant Ratner's.
Yeah.
And tell our younger listeners who may not recognize what Ratner's was, tell them about Ratner's.
Well, I will say for people probably over the age of 50, mm-hmm. if you say, and I did, I've done a lot of publicity for the hardcover tour, and I went around the country and I would talk, because the first part of the book is a lot about Ratner's mm-hmm. and the history of that restaurant. And I would sometimes be speaking in front of hundreds of people, and I would say, well, my mother was the daughter of the man who founded Ratner's restaurant. And mm-hmm. from the bowels of the audience, probably literally, you would just hear people be going, those onion rolls, the cheesecake. So Ratner's was this, probably in its heyday, it was in existence almost 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
So for probably 60 or 70 of those years, it was probably the most famous Jewish dairy restaurant in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you went, if you said Ratner's, if you were in Paris at mm-hmm. the fanciest restaurant and you're talking to the chef and you mentioned Ratner's, and he would flip out because mm-hmm. it was such an incredible place. It was not a deli, as many people think. It wound up for many years. Its second location was on Delancey Street.
Mm-hmm.
On the Lower East Side. It was a non-meat restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it was actually at the forefront of creating vegetarian cooking, which I didn't realize until really much, much, much later, really recently in doing my research, as they were cooking the things before it was a cuisine. It
right.
was just food,
right.
and then it,
right.
but they really were important in developing non-meat cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't say it was healthy cooking.
As
I say in the book, that you know there was a reasonable chance that halfway through a meal at Ratner's, you could actually feel your arteries starting to harden.
Mm-hmm.
But it was incredibly delicious. It was a crazy, crazy place with very eccentric waiters and.
Mm-hmm.
A very eccentric Lower East Side personnel, but it was around for close to 100 years, and it was truly legendary,
mm-hmm.
and my grandfather started it. My mother never worked there, but the rest of her siblings, most of her siblings did. She had mm-hmm. many, and quite a few of them did.
Mm-hmm.
I worked there once for a summer.
Mm-hmm.
Doing something completely unnecessary, which was they gave me a fake job because I was a family member. So I was sort of the maitre d', which is a way too fancy term for what I did, is I would try to seat people at the tables. except anyone who went to Ratner's always sat at the same table and wouldn't pay any attention to me whatsoever. There were many a day where I would say, yes, right this way, sir, and turn around and walk all the way to the back of the restaurant, and then turn around and realize he had sat at the first table that was available and
right.
was paying no attention to me. But the culture really shaped my mother, and in fact, her first cookbook, first of many.
Yes, I saw that.
Before she was really was in the food business, was she did a Ratner's cookbook.
Right.
Which, in fact, I'm trying to put back into print now because
oh,
it's
cool.
such a classic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's Rosh Hashanah today.
Exactly.
So that's even more perfect.
Yes, exactly right.
Yes, yes. Anyway, so then, kind of late in life, in her at 53 in 1975,
yes.
Judy goes to work at a very different restaurant in L.A., Ma
yes.
Maison. Can
what
you
happened?
Tell us, can you describe that restaurant and the way your mother ended up working there?
Well, it was funny because, again, her background was Ratner's, which, again, I can't stress how delicious it was, but I can't stress how not a sophisticated restaurant it was.
Right.
And my parents moved to Los Angeles because my father was a television writer and producer and ultimately director. And the business, the TV business, had left New York and gone to L.A., and he resisted it for a long time. But finally, we moved out there. I was a young boy. And over those my teenage years, they became more sophisticated, and they were hanging out with a kind of show business crowd.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, my father, the reason we moved out there was my father was hired to write and produce a television sitcom called The Bing Crosby Show,
mm-hmm.
which coincidentally starred Bing Crosby. And my
so
my
he
very,
was up there. He was
he was the, you know, Frank Sinatra and the Beatles
right,
of his day,
right,
and he was
right,
now
right,
older and
right.
doing his first television show,
mm-hmm.
and it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, for my very first, and again, the older audience will truly swoon, for my very first holiday out there, my parents had a holiday party in December, and Bing Crosby came and sat at the piano and played and sang White Christmas, which was, you know, his signature song. And, of course, I thought at age 10 or 11, well, he probably just goes around to people's houses and sings this all the time. I had no idea that it was something extraordinary. But so my father loved to entertain. He loved to have people over for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
My mother became a much better cook,
mm-hmm.
and they started to have dinner parties, and she became seriously interested in food.
Mm-hmm.
So this new restaurant, Ma Maison, opened up in the mid-70s,
mm-hmm.
and they became regulars. My dad loved going to restaurants and having them, you know, make a fuss over him. He was,
mm-hmm.
he was that kind of guy. And, you know, he loved knowing the waiters and getting his table and, you know, he just liked it.
Right.
And my mother liked it mostly because it was the first truly great restaurant in L.A., and she
mm-hmm.
loved the food.
Mm-hmm.
She could take all the fuss, but she
mm-hmm.
loved all the food. And the baby chef at that restaurant was Wolfgang Puck, his first
right.
restaurant.
Right.
And I happened to be there. I made my first trip back home. I had moved to New York. I went back to Los Angeles to see my parents over the holidays. My mother took me to Ma Maison for the first time, and the owner came over and sat with us at lunch. And my mom innocently said, "So what should I do to become a very good French cook?" And she meant something dilettantish, like, should I go to Paris for 3 weeks or
mm-hmm.
what, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And he said, "Come to work in the kitchen for a year, work 3 nights a week. We won't pay you. You will be our total servant. And at the end of a year, you'll be a really good French chef." And much to my shock, my mother went, in without blinking, "Okay." And even more to everybody's shock, rather than my father saying, "What? Who's going to make me dinner?" My father went, that's fantastic. It's great. You're going to have a whole new life. I love it.
Right.
And you know, they'd already been married for 25 years, 22 years at the time or something. And she went to work there. And within a year, she wasn't just a good French chef and cook. She opened up their cooking school, and she was cooking alongside and teaching alongside Julia Child and people like that. And she wound up, that became her life. And she wound up writing 8 cookbooks. And
it's a great story.
Started in her mid-50s. And what was so interesting, and I write about this a lot in my mother's kitchen, she was being mentored in the kitchen by the greatest chefs, particularly California chefs of that generation.
Time, yes.
Wolfgang Puck, Nancy Silverton, Jonathan Waxman, and they were all babies in a way.
Right.
They
right.
Were so
she was
young.
The experienced woman in the kitchen.
And she became, they mentored her in the kitchen, but
she
wound
mentored
up mentoring them,
in life. Them.
Exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
And she suddenly became a whole new person because my father had sort of been the dominant personality in our family. He was a big, outgoing personality. Mm-hmm. And suddenly my mother went, well, you know what? I'm really smart, and I have the answers to these questions, and I have really interesting anecdotes to tell these young chefs.
Mm-hmm.
And she became the mother to all of them, really.
Right.
And they were all going through sexual identity problems or marital problems or professional problems, and she became their counsel.
Okay.
And it was extraordinary to watch.
Peter, we have to take a break. It's time for our break. I want to recognize our departing Big Cheese engineer at HRN, David Tadashore. I've never said it out loud, and that's not good. But we will be back with Peter Gethers discussing his book, My Mother's Kitchen. See you soon.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
I forgot to mention that David is leaving HRN. That's why I wanted to mention him before the break. Goodbye, David. We wish you well. We'll miss you a lot. Anyway, Peter, we're back. Hi. So let's talk a little about your dad. You also followed a bit in his footsteps. And
I did. I combined both their careers.
Yes. My favorite dad story in the book was when you sent the very serious letter to him about sleeping with your girlfriend in his home when you were quite young. His answer was a nicely and largely drawn middle finger saying, received your letter, love, Dad.
Yes, exactly. No, it actually said, it was on his notepad. It said, from the desk of Stephen Gethers.
Yes.
And it said, Dear Pete, and in it was a perfectly traced raised middle finger.
Yes.
And then it just said, love, Dad. And I had written him the most pretentious, I was 21 years old.
Oh, 21. You
know, so only as a 21-year-old could do. I wrote him the most obnoxious, pretentious, self-satisfied, smug letter explaining
right.
why
he
was
needed
old
to let you
his
sleep.
His values were old-fashioned. And of course, I was waiting for him to pay for me to come back to L.A.
Right.
Ostensibly to see them, but actually see the girlfriend.
Right.
And I dropped the letter in the mailbox and then realized what I had done and panicked. And I called two or three days later saying, so did Dad get the letter I sent? And and my mother was saying, no, not yet. And then finally one day I called and I said, hi, Mom, did Dad get the letter? And she said, yes, I'll put your father on the phone, like that. And my blood ran cold and I begged him to tell me his response. And he said, you'll see it when you receive it. And I got that note. And of course, it was perfect because it put me in my place and made me feel
right.
so pretentious. And
right.
finally, I called him and said, okay, I got your note. I get it. And he said, would you like a real response? And I said, yes. And he said, you will understand this. He said, you're going to be in my house, and I'm too old to live by someone else's rules, and it would make me uncomfortable. You're welcome to bring her for dinner, and we'll see you as much as you want because we love you, but that's not happening. Okay, I'm sorry. You know, I apologize. I'm an idiot.
And I love that he signed it, Love, Dad. Like,
yeah,
you know, he was mad, but he wasn't that mad.
No, you know, he wasn't even mad. It was so funny. He was just... okay, my son's 21 years old. He's an idiot.
Right.
Then he knew exactly how to put me in my place.
Right. Another good part of your father's story is that after your mother's career in the LA food scene booms, he loves being called Mr. Judy Gethers.
Yes,
which is so wonderful.
Well, my mom, my dad was very successful.
Yes.
And again, it's hard to describe, but he had a big personality and mm-hmm. people really liked him. But you know, he was very sarcastic and he just was a big guy in all ways. And my mother was not. She was very quiet and meek. And in fact, it was only really after my father died, and I wrote about this extensively, that I realized my mother was the one with the spine in the family. She was made of steel. It's just that she was so quiet about it. And my father was so robust, you
mm-hmm.
know. But my mother was in many ways much stronger, really, as a person than my father, which she proved after he died and when she went through all the things she went through as she got older. And she suddenly was a star in the food world. And everybody loved her, and they loved being able to pay my dad back for making fun of them for so many years. So anytime he went into a restaurant, they would say, yes, we have a reservation for Mr. Judy Gethers. And my dad liked it. You know, he was so proud.
That's great. Now, we are on a cheese show, so cutting the curd. So let's talk about you and your mom's favorite cheese.
Well... you know, one thing I was going to do that I was unable to do for this book, I just sort of ran out of time,
mm-hmm.
but I found a fantastic cheesemaker in Tuscany, and I mm-hmm. was going to go work there and learn how to make cheese.
Oh, that half our listeners do that.
I didn't know that.
Well, we all want to go make cheese.
Yes. Well, we all want to make cheese. And I almost went and did it. I was going to live in this crummy trailer mm-hmm. And they were going to teach me. But it wound up not fitting in with the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother's favorite cheese of all time was this Burgundian French cheese called Epoisse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if your listeners have tasted it.
Oh, we all have.
It's quite potent.
Yes.
And it's sort of fainting cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother just loved it, as did I.
Mm-hmm.
And I still can remember, I'm going to make my life sound really glamorous, but honestly, it's not nearly this glamorous. But I was able to spend a year living in the south of France.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother came and visited. And we took her to this little restaurant in Burgundy. We were living farther south, but we took her to this restaurant in Burgundy, and I still remember they had a, you know, the steak, kind of steak frite steak, the really thin steak, and, mm-hmm. and it said steak with a poisson.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, they'll put a little, like a pat of butter size of a poisson on it. It was a huge steak, and the entire plate, entire steak was covered with melted poisson cheese. And it was, I still dream about it, actually.
I do notice one of your quotes in the book is, I might go so far to say a poisson is the best single food I can think of.
Yes, I think it's manna. I think it's manna from heaven. My mother's favorite. She loved that cheese, and I really do. If I had to only eat one thing, it probably would be that with
mm-hmm.
bread.
Mm-hmm.
That combined with the dessert wine Chateau Yquem was my mother's idea of perfection.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell me a little bit about your mother's health challenges in later life? And that she could still eat a poisson with bread after her stroke.
This is really and truly what made me write the book, is that when she was in her mid-80s, 85 or 86,
mm-hmm.
my mother had a massive stroke. And
mm-hmm.
she had already led this extraordinary life and had three different lives up till then and had outlived my father by quite a long time and written books and traveled the world. She was kind of anti-MAME-like in
mm-hmm,
a way,
mm-hmm.
if that means anything to the listeners. And I'm dating myself here, but she had a stroke, and the day of the stroke, I was in the emergency room with her, and the doctor came out and said, we think your mother is going to have locked-in syndrome, which means she will never be able to talk or move again.
Again, yeah.
The stroke hit the dead center of her brain, and not to get gruesome about it, but we didn't find her for 16 hours.
Oh.
So if...
I mean, remember that from the book.
That's an estimate that we think she had.
Ugh.
And normally if, you know, you don't find someone within an hour or two
right,
hours...
Right, it's top, bad news.
They don't make the recovery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he said, she's never going to be able to speak or move again. She'll be locked in.
Mm-hmm.
And 24 hours after that, I went to see her. And my mother had an incredible sense of humor. That was one of the things that really kept her going. My dad did too, but my mother's was very, very deep. And so there she was. And she looked as if, I have to say, she died already. I've never seen anyone look as terrible as this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walked in and I looked her into her hospital room and I said, like, hey, Mom, looking good. And gave her the thumbs up. And this woman who wasn't really supposed to move ever again at this point,
right.
She gathered up her strength and she crooked her finger, like, come closer,
mm-hmm.
her left finger, because her right side... She was paralyzed for a while, not
mm-hmm.
for too long, but
mm-hmm.
and she crooked her left finger, and I'm suddenly going, wait, I thought she couldn't move. And she indicated that I should lean close, and I did. And then she said, and by the way, she was not supposed to be able to talk ever again either.
Right.
She just said to me, don't be such a wise ass. And
oh, you must have been so happy.
Well, it was so shocking, and plus... You know, I was crying and sad and depressed, and then I'm laughing hysterically.
Mm-hmm.
And literally 2 weeks after that, she was moved to a rehab place where it was so severe. She didn't just have to relearn how to walk and eat and talk. She had to learn how to swallow because she couldn't even swallow properly.
Yeah.
And 6 weeks after that, I took her with my best friend, who'd known my mother since he was a little boy. We picked her up and took her out of the rehab place and took her to a holiday party that our friends
had every year
that mm-hmm. my mother loved. And she insisted on going, and she walked into the party. She wouldn't be wheeled in her wheelchair. She insisted on walking in with help. And then about a week or two 2 weeks after that, she was back home in her apartment.
Yeah.
So it was.
Now, what did the surgeon tell you? I mean, isn't one of your surgeons a very great guy who told you something about your mother's recovery?
Well, he's not a surgeon, but he's one of the great, gerontologists.
Oh,
he's
okay,
He's one of the great gerontologists in the country. And he said a few things. First, he said that when my mother made her recovery, he said, you know, he goes through this with a lot of elderly people. Their lives become diminished to a degree.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he said, one, your mother's recovery is not just in the top 2%. It's in the top two people recovering I've ever seen. And he said, you know, people get depressed because their lives are diminished. And my mother's life was definitely diminished, although she refused to buckle in.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I've talked to your mother at great length. I thought I should give her an antidepressant. And he said, she won't take one. And I've talked to her for hours and hours, and he goes, she's not depressed. I've never seen anyone not get depressed when this happens. And he said, she just decided, okay, here's what happened. I'll cope with it. I'll move on. I'll embrace what I can. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And she did. And I write about this in the book, the thing that actually drove me crazy. Really, when she was 90, I would call her up and say, Mom, I just heard about a great new restaurant. It opened a week ago, you know, the new Tom Colicchio restaurant. And I said, a friend told me about it. If I can get reservations, do you want me to take you Saturday night? And she'd go, been there. and of course, being still just as obnoxious and horrible as I was when I was 21, I'm thinking to myself, she's an elderly stroke victim. She can't possibly have been to a restaurant. And I'd say, no, Mom, this restaurant just opened up a week ago. And she'd go, I've been there. I went there Wednesday night. And I go, Mom, you're a 90-year-old stroke victim. How can you possibly be beating me to going to all these new restaurants? And she would just laugh and beam and go, been there. What can I tell you?
How did she get there? Who took her?
A friend. And she was very close with her niece, my cousin. And they used to go out all a lot. And my mother still knew everybody in the restaurant business. And Beth would call them and say, Judy Gethers wants to come, and they'd say, yay. Yeah, so she hit every new restaurant. I could never beat her to a new restaurant. It drove me crazy.
Oh, I don't blame you. That's so annoying.
So then the thing that was truly extraordinary about my mom is you thought, okay, that's the end of the story. That's going to be the most inspiring act, which was really act four. But in fact, it wasn't, because something else happened in the last couple of years of her life that really was crazy.
What happened?
When she was right after her 93rd birthday, she came out. I have a house in Sag Harbor in Long Island, and she came out there, and we had a big celebration. She came back to the city, and I remember this so distinctly. I was at a movie, and I came back, and I'm in a cab. I live downtown, and the cab is two or three blocks from my apartment in the Village, and my cell phone rings, and it's the woman from the agency that provided the aids, the live-in aids from my mom, which she needed after her stroke. By the way, women who, I don't know how people do this for a living. They were saints, and they were miraculous. And the head of the agency said, Peter, we think we have to rush your mother to the emergency room because, and I won't remember now the exact name of the test, but a type of blood test. She'd been given a test, and normal was supposed to be 1, and 3 was high, and my mother was 13.
Okay.
So they said, we think this is life-threatening. So I said, okay, look, but I need to think about this for 5 minutes, because my concern was my mom, and my mom had made it very clear to me that she did not want to die in a hospital.
Okay.
That was her, the most important thing to her at this point. She was crazed about it.
Uh-huh.
But I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I need 5 minutes to think about it. And I got home, cab dropped me off, and I paced around my apartment for 2 minutes and mm-hmm. hug my cat, you know, for solace. And the phone rings again. It says, we had to rush her to the hospital. She started bleeding profusely, mm-hmm. and we just had to do it. So I rush back uptown, and my mother looks at even worse than she did when she had her stroke. I've never mm-hmm. seen anyone look mm-hmm. like this. And my mother had an incredible pain tolerance,
mm-hmm.
something I have not inherited. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to the hospital if I have a splinter. And she just had extraordinary tolerance for pain, and she said she was in pain. And for my mother to say she was in pain—
Must have been big.
Big.
Yeah.
And she could barely move, and I thought, oh, my God, this is it. I talked to the palliative care people, and they were incredibly supportive. And I said, look, this story is not going where you think it's going. I told you this has a crazy, upbeat ending.
Okay, good, good.
They said, look, we think your mother has 2 days to a week to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, she doesn't want to be here. So they said, we'll get her home. We're just going to get the blood count thing that was 13. We can get rid of it in a couple of hours with intravenous
mm-hmm.
Liquids. And as soon as that's done, you can take her home and we'll provide home care, mm-hmm. hospice. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But she really has 2 days to two weeks to live.
Okay.
By 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my mother's home. She kind of wakes up. She's been in a daze, and she realizes she's home, and she looks at me, and she's confused. And my mother, I told you she had a great sense of humor, but she also was extraordinarily honest.
Mm-hmm.
She demanded honesty on all levels,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the reasons we had such a great relationship. And she could talk about anything. And so I said, Mom, look, you said you didn't want to die in the hospital. This is the end game.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought you home, and you're going to have drugs, whatever you need. You're going to be totally comfortable, but I brought you home. And I said, I hope that's all right. And she said, that's wonderful. And I settled in, and over the next week, she was very weak and not mm-hmm. really able to talk or move mm-hmm. very much. And all my friends came by to say goodbye, and we all went, okay, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can tell you is 3 weeks after that, my mother went out for a pastrami sandwich at a restaurant, ate the entire thing. She came to our Thanksgiving dinner as a surprise. There was really people came by to say goodbye to her because she used to come to our Thanksgiving every
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And my best friend's wife, who also had known her since she was young, called my mother and said, I'm so sad. I'm not going to see you at Thanksgiving dinner tonight. I can't believe you're not going to be there. And my mother said, oh, me too. I'll really miss you. But she had already plotted out a surprise visit. And she came in the door in her wheelchair for Thanksgiving. And my friend's wife just rushed up to her and said, you stinker. How could you do that to me? I never saw my mother so happy that she had pulled off this major joke. But literally, she was out 3 weeks after they told me she couldn't eat anything but ice chips.
Uh-huh.
And that she would have 2 weeks to live tops, probably
right,
2 days.
Right.
Her aide called me up and said, you're not going to believe this. Your mother insisted on going out to her favorite deli to get a pastrami sandwich. And I went, what? What? And I went up to see her, and she was fine.
Oh,
and
gosh.
That's the same doctor who had told me.
Right. Such longevity.
He came over, and I said, I thought you told me she couldn't eat, and
right.
there was this. And he said, what your mother is doing is actually impossible. I want you to understand that. It's not humanly possible. And he said, but it's your mother. So.
Right, right. How long after that?
She lived for another several months.
Okay.
She died, actually. So this was in October, November.
Mm-hmm.
And she died on February 1st.
Mm-hmm.
And really, up until the last 24 hours, she was going to the table for breakfast and lunch, and she was enjoying herself. Mm-hmm. And she was going out for, as she put it, not, she would say, I'm going out for a walk. And then she would say, well, I'm going out for a ride, because she was in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And I had had a dry January. Mm-hmm. I decided I wasn't going to drink for the entire month of January. Mm-hmm. And my mother, and I can't say this is really conscious, but I wouldn't be shocked, she died on February 1st. So I was able to drink very heavily that night. So it was her last act of mercy for me.
Well, this is just a wonderful story. I love your book. I love your mother. It's been great interviewing you, and I want to thank you for coming on Cutting the Curd. Thank you so much.
Anytime you want. It's a great show, and I'm thrilled.
Okay.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.